And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 2, through chapter 2, verse 7. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant, your name is oil poured out. Therefore, virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will exult and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. I am very dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not gaze at me because I am dark, because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon, for why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? If you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow in the tracks of the flock and pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tents. I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make for you ornaments of gold studded with silver. While the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, my truly delightful. Our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedar. Our rafters are pine. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. As a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women. As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. In every generation, there is a way of wisdom and a way of folly. During the Reformation, the way of wisdom, the reformers. The way of folly, the Roman Catholic establishment. During the American Revolution, the way of wisdom, the colonists and liberty. The way of folly, the Tories and tyranny. During the modernist fundamentalist controversy of the early 20th century, the way of wisdom, biblical conservatives. The way of folly, the evolutionist liberals. So it was in Solomon's day. The way of wisdom for a virtuous woman, that is our subject in the Song of Solomon, the way of wisdom for a virtuous woman was as it ever was meant to be, that is, one man, one woman marriage, ideally expressed in Proverbs 31, one that was rock solid and white hot, as we have seen. The way of folly was the luxurious life of the harem, filled with the numberless distractions of the flesh, sexual pleasure, perfumes and ointments, fine clothes, soft fabrics, wine, and the best of foods from around the world. Not an easy choice. Now, if you have not listened to the introduction yet from a couple of weeks ago, I just urge you to do so, where we lay the groundwork for this unfolding, this interpretation of the Song of Solomon. Not an easy choice between these two, between the way of wisdom and the way of folly. Especially when you are a small-town farm girl accustomed to working in the fields under the hot Mediterranean sun. While you would never know the solid biblical joys of covenant marriage and childbearing by opting for life in Solomon's harem, you would have all the risks and pains and uncertainties of life swept away, every whim and need of the flesh gratified. But your soul would be hollow. Your conscience would be heavy, nagging you day and night. Such is the choice of folly for all in every generation. But for our Shulamite girl, life in the harem would become, in many respects, boring and repetitive. One historian of the harems of ancient Egypt called life in them a tedious existence. You would die empty, unfulfilled, and singing an early version of Wanda Jackson's Silver Threads and Golden Needles. Anybody remember that song? Some of you gray hairs may remember that one, right? I don't want your lonely mansion with a tear in every room. I just want the love you promised beneath the haloed moon. But you think I should be happy with your money and your name and pretend that I don't notice while you play your cheating games. Silver threads and golden needles cannot patch this heart of mine, and I dare not drown my sorrow in the warm glow of your wine. Now, Google this song, and great country song. And really, a harem was, by definition, a systematized, regularized cheating game, wasn't it? Never fails to amaze. Only a man with no limits on his earthly power, no limits on his fleshly appetites, could conceive of and cultivate the institution of the harem. But so it was from earliest times among the great potentates of history. So it was with Solomon, who resolved, you remember from Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity, unquote, from Solomon. But of course, that conclusion was 700 wives and 300 concubines later. Meanwhile, over 1,000 women sang an ancient Hebrew version of Silver Threads and Golden Needles. But not everyone, right? Not everyone. 1 in 1,000. This, of course, was our girl, the Shulamite woman. And she makes her choices, okay? Let's look at the choices she makes and begin with point one. Our title today is Harem. We must be oriented, properly so, if we're going to interpret this text as was meant to be. First of all, point one, verses 2 through 4, harem. Voices of the harem beckon yet another virgin to join them with the fame of Solomon's lovemaking, verses 2 through 4. Now, if we're going to get the Song of Solomon right, it is imperative to see the setting of this song as the harem. The entire song is incoherent otherwise. We read briefly from Esther chapter 2 just to get a sense for harem life and so forth. This is what is transpiring here. It will become starkly apparent as we go along. But for now, It must be stipulated and then demonstrated. It's part of our working hypothesis that the situation is indeed that of the harem. But when we order the dialogues, then in four voices, all falls into place, and wisdom shines forth luminescently. Those four voices are the voices of the harem girls, Solomon, the Shulamite woman, and the shepherd boy. And the shepherd boy. In verse 2, we begin with the voices of the harem girls. In many of your translations, you have superscriptions which are not part of the text. Let me tell you that right from the get-go. The superscriptions you have in your translations are not part of the text. For example, the ESV has "the bride confesses her love," followed by "she." Verse 4 summarily dismisses any other options for the first person plural, that is, it begins with "we will exult," with the bland generic "others." Really? Others? As in no other translation of any other book of the Bible, you must assiduously ignore these presumptuous edits. No other book more so than here in the Song of Solomon. Chapter divisions, superscriptions are interpretations of the text, not translations. And they're not always good interpretations either. In fact, there seems to be as many classifications as you may have an ESV in your lap, but they do the same thing, King James, NIV, many other translations. So it should immediately raise a red flag for you. Ever since this book was received into the canon of Scripture, the prime directive of every interpreter, Jewish or Christian, was to sort out the voices of the speeches. Right? Sort out the voices of the speeches. It was and is both the book's greatest challenge and conversely its greatest blessing, too. And I dare say that every serious student of the Bible, when they encounter the Song of Solomon, either for the first or the thousandth time, ask themselves at various junctures in the book, wait, who exactly is it speaking here? What's the context for this speech? Where does it end and another begin? Is there any coherence to all of this? Right? Deb listens on her to MP3 version of the Bible about four times a year. She goes through the whole Bible. Every time she comes to the Song of Solomon, she asks those questions. Right? No immediate clarity yet, sweetheart, but it's coming, okay? Some blame the author for this seeming problem. How could Solomon let such a glorious theme sink into such apparent incoherence? Can Solomon be so wise and yet write such an ambiguous work? Well, all I can say to this after years and years of working through this, not every day, but you know, from time to time you come back to this book, and all I can say is, voila, behold the nexus of wisdom. Solomon, in his wisdom, expected you to labor over the interpretive model that best makes sense of these speeches. We don't just throw up our hands and say they are a collection of erotic poems, random and just gathered together, right? When you labor to best make sense of these speeches with a variety of interpretive models, you finally seize on the one that works the best. Therein, wisdom is both cultivated and perfected. There is no glib and easy answer. If you claim to get this work in one reading, you're either a genius or a monumental cheat. The Song of Solomon is an interpretive puzzle like no other in all the ancient world, and meant to be. So, a major challenge of wisdom in the song is assigning the voices to the main characters, for that matter, or even deciding how many characters there are. We have determined, of course, we have the virtuous woman, we have King Solomon, we have the harem girls, and we have the shepherd boy, the four voices of the Song of Solomon. So much can go wrong when a character is left out, or a bit of dialogue is misassigned to another character. But the ambiguity is deliberate. You cannot simply pigeonhole voices either by the gender, number, and person of the verbs and pronouns, too. That's done a lot, maybe in your own translation. It's a simplistic blind alley. Wisdom is shown forth in the greatest congruity demonstrated between speeches, characters, and interpretive models chosen. Well, all of that being said, suffice it to say, the interpretive model put forth here is the most coherent. That's a bit presumptuous, but I hope to justify it in the following weeks, okay? So bear with me and see if it doesn't finally seem to be so at the end for you too. But the key is understanding that Solomon meant to locate wisdom not in pro forma application of rules onto the text, but rather by discovering the interpretive model that best comports with biblical wisdom. I hope that the following model does just that for you. So with all that said, assume for the sake of argument for now that a girl from the harem, rather than the bride, a girl from the harem issues these exclamations of ecstasy over Solomon's lovemaking. Okay? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, etc., etc., right? It is here in these verses 2 through 4 that the lovemaking prowess of Solomon is highlighted in order to entice yet another virgin into the harem. Note the metaphors and allusions used here. First of all, Solomon's a good kisser. As in the French language, kissing is a metaphor for the whole context of the bedroom. Right at the beginning, the promise is to the virtuous woman that she'll find sexual pleasure with him. Secondly, his love is better than wine. Wine in the palace is plentiful of haute couture, right, and intoxicating. The only thing that excels palace wine is Solomon's lovemaking. Number three, he smells good. He smells good too, right? Once more, the palace harem is lush with oils and lotions from around the world, and a young girl could indulge her senses for hours with them, trying this one and that one all day if she wanted. Men, however, are notoriously stinky. Even after taking a shower, I know this from experience, sometimes I have to take two showers just to be presentable, right? But not Solomon. Also, women get the flutters just hearing his name. Your name is oil poured out, right? Fragrant oil poured out makes one swoon. Solomon's reputation is justified. The harem girls swoon just hearing his name. Pretty cool, huh, guys? Huh? Pretty cool. And number five, the ad campaign is generally a resounding success. The virgins love him. As all of this gets around Jerusalem and the countryside, the virgins, the loveliest of Israel's young women, flock to the harem. Number six, you also see the ad campaign seems to have a tagline, "Draw me after you, let us run." Every good brand, right, has a saying. Solomon knew this back then. Every harem girl was ready if it was her turn, if he was coming for her, "Draw me after you, let us run." And enviously, the others would look on as she cast a glance over her shoulder and she would whisper, "The king has brought me into his chambers." It was the culminating aspiration of every harem girl. It was the culmination of years of preparation, a la Esther, right? Esther was in the harem for years, being prepared. All those years were finally paying off. A night with the king. Well, the commercial for the benefit of our Shulamite girl ends with a chorus from the harem as we shift from the first person singular feminine to the first person plural. We will exult and rejoice in you, right? And through the brief speech there, the brief chorus of the harem girls. Solomon is a phenom, not just with a naive, wonderstruck virgin here and there. No. With one voice, the harem exclaims his lovemaking prowess. You're in for the time of your life, girl, if you just come along with us. So, this opening speech by the harem, this opening speech is a kind of Super Bowl halftime show meant to sweep a young girl off her feet. And with 700 wives and 300 concubines, the flower of Israel's womanhood, it was spectacularly successful, too. But just digress for a minute, too, and we'll be reflecting on some of these aspects as we go along. Just imagine for a moment what that does to the strength of a nation, however, too, when the best and beautiful are all hoarded for the pleasure of one man, while the men of the nation go without, right? What does that do to an entire nation? Well, spectacularly successful for most of the girls of the kingdom, right? The Super Bowl halftime show meant to entice them. But would it work on this virtuous woman? This woman in the tradition of Proverbs 31, right? The Proverbs 31 woman, we looked at this last week. We see the canonical link between that last song in Proverbs, Proverbs 31, the Proverbs 31 woman, and then the next book in the canon is Ruth, who is also called, in link, a virtuous woman. And now Song of Solomon, directly following Ruth. Once again, I encourage you to look at the introduction to this series, where you'll see these themes laid out. And my hypothetical case here for our thesis. All right? She's in the heritage of Ruth. Would this glitz and show work on her? Even having a nickname, Shulamith writes, a nickname bearing Solomon's consonants with feminized vowels. You can hear the link with Solomon and Shulamith, right? Would all of this work on this virtuous woman? Having even a name like Solomon's, having perhaps a wisdom that would match and even surpass Solomon's own. That is going to be one of the points and the upshot of this book. Solomon does not come off well in the Song of Solomon, demonstrating a humility in his old age that perhaps seeking the pleasure of the harem was not, after all, a wise move. That perhaps one of the women who turned him down was wiser than him. That brings us to point two. Harem. The voice of the Shulamite woman calls upon her shepherd boy rather than Solomon. The voice of the Shulamite woman calls upon her shepherd boy rather than Solomon. It's important to postulate a shepherd boy in this because if you don't, then you have the whole thing collapse in on itself in incoherence. The only way Song of Solomon remains coherent is to postulate a shepherd boy in here rather than just three characters. So, verses 5 through 7. Shulamith's first speech. Her first speech is a modest one. She'll downplay her own beauty and worthiness and call out to her shepherd boy. One gets the impression that perhaps she is taken aback at this full court press by the recruiting team from the harem. Perhaps she's never even dreamed or considered herself as a candidate for the king's harem. Seems to be indicated in her speech. She confesses, first of all, number one, her intrinsic beauty. Her intrinsic beauty is nevertheless unrefined. She responds to the human resource team sent to recruit potential talent for the harem, the Daughters of Jerusalem. It's a euphemism that we'll see used throughout the song for this crew from the human resource team. And she responds to them with a kind of self-effacing admission of her core beauty. I am dark but lovely. I am dark but lovely. She is aware of her stunning beauty, which the recruiters have picked up on and in which they see great potential. But Shulamith then goes on to plead how she has had to neglect refining that beauty owing to having to labor in the fields, tending vineyards and shepherding goats. We know this because she likens her skin to the tents of Kedar, and they were notoriously made of dark animal hides, and the curtains of Solomon. They were dark in the bedroom, too, meant to be opaque for privacy's sake. And secondly, life circumstances have prevented her from cultivating her native beauty. Without going into a detailed family history, she describes how her brothers, for one reason or another, perhaps from envy of her beauty and her potential, put her in the fields to tend the family vineyard. So busy was she that she was not able to cultivate her own vineyard, a euphemism for her native feminine gifts and beauty. Unable to cultivate because she was in the vineyards all day. She then, in a moment of insecurity, wistfully calls out to what she knows. That is the love and security of her shepherd boy. Tell me, you whom my soul loves. You whom my soul loves. An important phrase here. The idea of soul love. And we begin to see now, for the first time, the contrast with a decadent scene of We begin to see the contrast with a decadent scene of Solomon's court. We see a love nurtured from childhood, which is rock solid and white hot, as we have characterized the love between the shepherd boy and the Shulamite woman. We see that in chapter 8 in her concluding speech. They have a love that is rock solid and white hot. That is a true covenant love, hearkening back to chapter 2 of Genesis. Her love is, to the core, nephesh, Hebrew for soul, for life, for very life. Her love is to the core nephesh, bound up with the soul. It is simply incoherent to attribute this nephesh love to Solomon. She's had no experience with him, and it has just dawned on her that she might even have a chance at enlisting in his harem. No, her love is bound up with the one who tends flocks in the hood. And she wistfully wonders where he might be at that moment, right? At about noon. Where are you? You know, you pasture your flock where you make it lie down at noon. That's the hottest time of the day, and flocks would always bed down in the shade for those hottest hours. She wonders where precisely he may be because she doesn't want to wander around looking for him like some prostitute. Classic characterization, veiled, wandering among the flocks. Prostitutes did ply their trade in veils among the pastures. We know this not only from historical record, but also from the scriptures. Judah and Tamar. Look up the story of Judah and Tamar. That's precisely where Judah went to find a prostitute among the flocks. And he came upon Tamar, who was wearing a veil. It also is a veiled reference, if I can make that pun, also a veiled reference to the daughters of Jerusalem, who, though perhaps more sophisticated and refined, were nevertheless whores for Solomon, right? In the end, ultimately. Well, just parenthetically, you might want to talk to your kids about the nature of this. When you go home, I've talked to a couple of you fathers. This might be a good opportunity just to talk about some of these issues and these things with your kids, especially your older ones. Because these are real life issues, are they not? Well, that then brings us to the counter response of the harem. Let's look at verses 8 through 17. Harem. Voices of the harem extol both her intrinsic beauty and also the luxury of life in the king's palace. Voices of the harem extol both her intrinsic beauty and the luxury of life in the king's palace. Now, once again, you must assiduously ignore the assignment of voices in the translations. They're not there in the original. They're an interpretation, not a translation. And although the voices will alternate between singular and plural, replete with titles of affection, little pet names, right? They're collectively the seductive voices of the harem, charming and disarming Shulamith to join them. And they tell her in verse 8 there, they tell her, in effect, park your goats with ours. Solomon's herds are so large they create a four-lane highway to the pasture. Just follow the tracks, merge your flock with his, and bring them to his shepherds. They'll take it from there. This is also a euphemism as well for what will happen to her as she is incorporated into the harem. She will be shepherded into the flock of Solomon's herd as another heifer, if you will. But they also confess that your beauty is noble and graceful and captivating to the idea of a mare. In verses 9 and 10, they're not saying she looks like a horse, okay? No. She's like one of the well-bred mares of the Egyptian cavalry. 3,000 years the Egyptians have had to refine their horses. And over the centuries, Egyptian cavalry was composed strictly of stallions. So a mare among the stallions, imagine that, would provoke excitement and consternation. And they're saying, you're like a mare among the cavalry of Egypt. You will provoke consternation as well and excitement with Solomon. And then in verse 11, we will refine your beauty. We'll adorn you with jewels. We'll add to your beauty. We will adorn you and refine, help to refine your beauty. You've not had an opportunity to tend your vineyard? Well, we will take care of that. We will help you. And fourthly, Solomon is also a skilled and seductive lover. That's the upshot then of verses 12 through 14. While the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved to me is a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. En-Gedi was an oasis on the Dead Sea that still has a reputation for being a beautiful, verdant place in a very dead, dry desert. So Solomon is here characterized. Her response then is chronicled in metaphor all through here. The response of the harem girls to Solomon is given to us in verses 12 through 14. And as well, then, in verses 15 through 17, they are telling her, telling the Shulamite girl, that your circumstances should match your beauty. They flatter her with words, right? Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedar. Our rafters are pine. Indeed, enticing her again with beautiful, lovely, verdant, green circumstances in which she can live. Her circumstances should match her beauty. The palace is lush and flush and lofty. Come and join us. Their second pitch, okay? What is her response? Verses 1 through 7 of chapter 2. Verses 1 through 7 of chapter 2. In contrast, the voice of the Shulamite woman extols her shepherd boy and adjures the harem girls. Okay? She brings an adjuration to the harem girls. Returning to her thoughts of the shepherd boy, Shulameth reflects, first of all, verses 1 through 2, on her own gifts and place. Verses 1 through 2. I'm a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. As a lily among the brambles, so is my love among the young women. She reflects on her own gifts, her own place. In her own village, she is an acknowledged beauty, a worthy woman, a virtuous woman. She doesn't need the validation of Solomon and his harem. Rose of Sharon. Sharon was a region along the Jordan River known for its beautiful flowers, flowers cultivated still there today. She, being a lily among brambles, her beauty was luminescent, stood out even at home. She didn't need the validation of Solomon's court for that beauty. It might also be an allusion to her present situation among the envoys from the harem, a lily among brambles. You girls are brambles in comparison to a virtuous woman. And then in verses 3 through 6, she asserts that her shepherd boy is every match for Solomon as a lover, perhaps even more so, right? An apple tree among the trees of the forest, standing out, bearing fruit, delicious, fruitful. And then a whole series of allusions to love and affection, the banqueting house, the feast of love between the two. Beautiful, simple, peasant love, right? Covenant love. The banner, instead of a lavish tent covering of the royal house, the banner that she has over her from him is love. It was covenant love, not luxury. And so saying that her shepherd boy and his love was every match for that of Solomon and his court, everything that he could offer, she found already in her shepherd boy. She turns on the daughters of Jerusalem, compelling an oath here in verse 7. She turns on the daughters of Jerusalem, compelling an oath. She does not submit, does she? She does not say, all right, trundle along to the harem. No. She successfully resists this initial temptation and, in fact, is strengthened in her love for the shepherd boy. And she brings an adjuration to the daughters of Jerusalem, to the envoys from the harem. An adjuration to adjure, in the English word here at least, is composed of two words, ad, that is to, jure, law, to the law, an oath to law. More the sense of to the covenant, however, in the Hebrew. That is, I call you to a covenant oath. Very strong statement here. It invokes a solemn covenant oath upon the harem. And the witnesses to this oath are graceful, lovely, innocent, virgin creatures of the field. Particularly, those words indicate a virgin creatures. And she invokes them to swear. She invokes them to swear, don't stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now that sounds all sweet and sentimental, doesn't it? But it's much more than that. It's the idea, do not indulge the pleasures of covenant love. Don't indulge the pleasures of covenant love without true covenant love being present. Do not steal the fruits of love's harvest. Do not steal the fruits of love's harvest without the labor of planting and husbanding and harvesting true covenant love. That is the sense of this adjuration, which, of course, the life they are bidding her to does. It does all of that. It indulges the pleasures of covenant love without covenant love being present. It steals the fruit of love's harvest. Harem life steals the fruit of love's harvest without the labor of planting and husbanding and harvesting true covenant love, which she and her shepherd boy have been doing all of their lives. So, with this adjuration, which ends this first major section, we have four major sections. There are four adjurations that conclude each of the major sections, affirming once again her stance in covenant love, biblical covenant love, hearkening back to chapter 2 of Genesis. Here, Shulamith has shown wisdom beyond the harem, beyond that of Solomon. She has successfully passed her first test of probation. She has proven loyal to the vision of covenant love. The adjuration is a dramatic conclusion to section 1. There will be three more. She will finally conclude, of course, in chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. Triumphantly, set me as a seal upon your heart, she will say to the shepherd boy, as a seal upon your arm, heart, and strength. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as fierce as the grave. Her love is just that, rock solid. True covenant love is also white hot, as we've said. It flashes, its flashes, she says in chapter 8. Love's flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. That's true covenant love. It is rock solid. It is white hot. It is inextinguishable. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can floods drown it, despite what harems try to do to you. And it is priceless. She will go on to say, if a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. Right? Priceless. All this being dangled in front of her eyes. The wealth of Solomon's house will be yours. Pleasures beyond knowledge, right? And it is fulfilling, too, in the end, fulfilling true covenant love. I was in his eyes, verse 10 of chapter 8. I was in his eyes, that is my shepherd boy. I was in his eyes as one who finds peace. There is true shalom in covenant love. The idea not just of surcease from conflict, but also the idea of fruitfulness and blessing. Every generation faces these things, faces the compromise offered by culture. Oftentimes dangled in front of our eyes, we have those choices in our own lives as well. This text also points to Ephesians chapter 5, too. The kind of love found in Ephesians chapter 5, perhaps Paul had this book at his elbow as he composed chapter 5. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loves the church. And of course, this will point ultimately to that pure bride of Christ, the church, with whom there must be no compromise, no other Lord, no other Savior, no other husband, but the bride of Christ indeed wedded to her Christ, characterized as a bride adorned for her husband descending from heaven, right? As we saw in the book of Revelation. So what a beautiful story this unfolds for us, as indeed Shulamith, that's her nickname, with the consonants of Solomon and the vowels of the bride, Shulamith, as she indeed navigates her way through the temptations of the harem. Well, let us come to that place then where we find our bridegroom emblemized, and that time of rejoicing, that time of the wedding feast to come, emblemized for us in the bread and water, the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord, the blood and body of Christ in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.